Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of July. It's all things political for this hour. We will continue to be talking about the oil disaster in the Gulf. We'll talk about the suicide bombings in Uganda. Wasn't that a terrible story as people were watching the World Cup finals? We'll talk about the World Cup a little bit this hour as well. Robert Gibbs said at a press conference, I believe, on Friday that he, or no, it was on Meet the Press, I think, yesterday, that he thought that the Republicans could take over the House. If so, by how much? Maybe Paul the Octopus ought to. Wasn't that an amazing story that Paul the Octopus ought to be able to tell us? We'll talk about immigration. Our guest the first half hour has done a study of who the Tea Party activists are, so we will look at that and more, whatever you'd like to talk about. We have two guests with us this hour. David Winston is our first guest, president of the Winston Group, a strategic planning and survey research firm. He was formerly director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, where he oversaw initiatives ranging from education, taxes, Social Security, health care, and technology to the 21st Century Congress. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation doing statistical policy and economic modeling and served as a senior staffist or person in a senior staff role to four RNC chair. He is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and also an election analyst for CBS. Here's our phone number for you to join our conversation. You're always welcome to do so. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay, doing well.
Good. Where do you want to start? We have a lot here. Should we start with the World Cup? Spain
sure.
won.
Yeah, and hopefully maybe I can do more for everybody than the octopus did. So
wasn't that a story
that
could
kind
do
of
this?
Strange, and it only goes to show you, like, you know, there are sort of odd anomalies in terms of predictions, and so but apparently it worked. So
yeah, apparently it did. Coupled, unfortunately, with this horrible suicide bombing in Uganda, do we have much information on that? Al-Qaeda, I guess, according to the news, is taking responsibility. Do you know why they would target World Cup fans in Uganda?
I don't know. I mean, I have to. Well, let's start off with the basic premise of why they're doing any of it, and then why this specific target. I just find this remarkable that, one, that they were willing to embrace it so quickly, in the sense of if there was an area of the world where perhaps there might be some potential. Working this out in a different way, and instead they, you know, here's one more continent they put on the list of people who are going to be adamantly opposed to them, and I don't understand it anyway, but this one in particular is equally as baffling.
Right, it sure is. Did you watch a lot of the World Cup? I must say I was sitting there all afternoon yesterday waiting for a goal.
Yeah, I'm sort of a fan of, soccer, football, and actually, I had been sort of a Dutch fan, Holland, and because I remember vividly the 1978 final when they lost to Argentina in overtime 2-1. So it was yet one more time where they lost in overtime. Although I have to say, Spain was the better team yesterday. Unfortunately,
yeah. It's such a world sport. Why doesn't it catch on? It is starting to in this country, but so many young people play soccer. You'd think it would be a big deal in America.
Well, I think, one of the elements that exists here, and not to get in the weeds in this, but, I mean, it's the scoring element. American fans are used to lots more scoring than exists in soccer matches, and so it's just a difference. But I do think, I mean, particularly given the level of viewing that occurred in terms of this World Cup, because all the games are on, I think you'll see, and the performance of the U.S. team, I think you'll see some expansion in terms of people watching. But we'll see. They're up against, you know, some pretty popular sports, and football and basketball, baseball.
Right. And that LeBron James story, oh my gosh, they were watching it in my household, and I said, this has been going on all day? All day? What does that say about us?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it says that he is a remarkably clever person when it comes to public relations. He may be better at public relations than he is at basketball, which is pretty amazing. And it certainly financially worked out quite well for him.
Right.
I guess the only loser here really was sort of the people of Cleveland, although my sense is that some folks there, given the way he was behaving here, were just glad to see him go. So.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I didn't mean to talk sports with you. It's been a weekend of a lot of sports. Robert Gibbs said, I think yesterday on Meet the Press, that there's a good chance that the Republicans could take the House. We're looking at maybe 39 seats in the House. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think they will?
I think it's a little... I'm going to give you a slightly different take. I certainly think there are a lot of things in place that give Republicans the opportunity. Clearly, the economy has not gone in the direction that the president wanted. The idea that the stimulus package would keep unemployment at 8% clearly has not occurred. And I think there's a very large frustration with that direction, and also the fact that, to some degree, he hasn't necessarily always focused on the economy, sort of drifting off into other issues. So at least for Republicans, the door is wide open. The challenge to Republicans here, and not to actually sound not quite as optimistic as Robert Gibbs, which is sort of an odd contrast to say the least, but I think the challenge to Republicans is that people still remember 2006 and the Republicans back then. So I think the challenge to Republicans is it's not merely enough that Barack Obama isn't doing well. They have to be very clear about what the alternative is going to be. If you get a Republican majority, what does that mean? And that's something that the Republicans are in the process of trying to put together, and they're supposed to come out in the middle of September and sort of lay out to everybody. But that's the big piece here that's not been sort of put into the mix.
And if you were strategizing, and you are, I'm sure, with some of these people, what does the alternative mean? What should it be?
No, I mean, I think at this point, where the country's at is they are just completely focused on the economy and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
To do this sort of analogy, just think of a house with a roof on fire. If you looked at the rest of the house, windows may need repair, electrical work may need to be done, the foundation may be need reworking, and that's sort of like the other issues, healthcare, et cetera. The bottom line is until the fire is put out, the rest of it really doesn't matter, and I think that's where the public's at this point. And so what they want to hear from Republicans, okay, great, he's not putting out the fire, how are you going to do it? And they want to hear something that sounds credible, and so it's predominantly a jobs creation economic focus, and that's what Republicans have to lay out.
Mm-hmm. It's such a difficult issue, and it's affecting so many people. I think you're right that the focus hasn't been on this. There's so many people who are graduating from college who can't find jobs. There are people who've been laid off. It's just affecting everybody.
And what happens when the issue is jobs is that people, because it's so fundamental to what you can do in life. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, raise a family, be able to, you know, buy clothes, take care of your kids. I mean, just fundamental stuff. That as a result of that, people become much less partisan and much less ideological, because what's at stake is much more central to them just being able to survive day to day. For political people, that makes it much more risky, in the sense of people aren't going to behave the way you normally expect. And so how do you address those concerns? And I think you've seen the president not quite grasp that, but just because he didn't doesn't necessarily mean that Republicans will gain the majority, like I said. I mean, they have an opportunity here, but they have to turn around and lay something out clearly to the country, so the country says, okay, at least there's some sense from Republicans that they have an understanding and direction where to go.
And are they having a hard time doing that, David, because the party is, you know, it's Tea Party people, it's mainstream Republicans, it doesn't have a clear identity?
Well, anytime you come off of a major sequence of losses like Republicans did in 2006 and 2008, one of the most difficult things is to sort of create harmony and unity within the party right after that, because everybody is sort of coming up with their 18 reasons why things fell apart. And so you've got that dynamic. The other thing is it's just hard to put together a majority coalition and sustain it. I mean, you're watching Speaker Pelosi deal with that in the House, where she's got a lot of very sort of conservative Dems who make it very difficult in terms of sustaining a majority coalition. The candidate who just won for the Democrats, taking over Murtha's seat in Pennsylvania 12, which was a big deal election in terms of where things might go, ended up basically running against ran against the health care plan and against President Obama, which gives you a sense of just how difficult that coalition is on the Democratic side. Equally, on the Republican side, trying to put together a coalition beyond your base is just, it's very complicated to do. How do you get that political center along with Tea Party folks, along with social conservatives, and meld that together in terms of majority coalition is not a simple task by any stretch.
I know your organization did a study recently of who the Tea Party activists are. Who are they?
Well, not surprising. They tend to be slightly older. They're much more middle income, so it's not like they're at either end of the income scale. They are more so Republican. 57% are Republican, but the remaining 43% are either independent or Democrat, so there's a large chunk that are not. They tend to be more conservative. 66% are conservative, but again, you've got the remainder being mostly moderate. There's some liberals, but mostly moderate. So while it tends to be a slightly more Republican conservative group, it also encompasses a variety of other individuals that, and which just, you know, moderate Democrats are concerned about what spending and where the deficit is going at this point. And that tends to be what binds this group, is this concern that spending and the size of government is sort of getting out of control. So, again, while they may dislike, and they do, the president quite a bit, and they're not particularly happy with Democrats in Congress, Republicans in Congress still have not made a sale yet, in the sense of there's some hesitation, given, again, going back to 2006, the concerns they have about the way Republicans performed when they had the majority.
Can you talk about this debate concerning job creation and the deficit? Do we need to, do you think, really be concerned about cutting spending and attacking the deficit, or is it okay to have a fairly high deficit if you're creating jobs?
Well, this is where perhaps at an ideological level I may actually come across a little bit more ideological than I normally do, and that I tend to be a pretty hardcore supply sider, so I'm not a fan of the idea that sort of Keynesian economics of you spend in order to sort of increase the level of economic activity and that'll create jobs. My sense is you need to focus on the private sector. Now, that's a very biased personal view. Now, having said, where's the country at in terms of that? I think that where the country is at is, as they originally gave the president the benefit of the doubt in terms of the stimulus package, in terms of spending that significant amount of money, some $800 billion. And so far, that does not seem to have reaped any rewards. And so I think where you see the country is at this point is when certain individuals like Paul Krugman in the New York Times, who clearly has been the strongest advocate in terms of the left pushing increased spending, I think where you see the electorate at this point is, well, it didn't seem to work particularly well before. Why would we go do that now? Again, now this goes back to the point I was making earlier. Right now, though, that's the only option on the table. Sort of Republicans haven't said much, and so it's kind of a binary yes or no to that. We'll see how that evolves as the campaign emerges. But I think at this point, the country hasn't seen success from that spending, and so they're just very concerned about taking, you know, going back to that same well again and trying that policy again.
David Winston, our guest, it's All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email talk@wpr.org. We start our calls with June from Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, David.
Hi.
I'm kind of discouraged at this point, and as I talk to my friends, older and younger, I find they're pretty in bad shape. And I'm wondering, as a person who voted for Obama, as a person who supported my rep, Steve Kagan, who doesn't look like he'll have much chance of winning a third term, why are these people willing to give up a generation of young people, of sick people who can't get insurance, of old people, to a kind of saying, I'm Barack Obama, I'm in the middle, I support Republicans, I support conservative Democrats. Where did he get lost? Is it in the depths of the Gulf of Mexico, or where? These people are not going to make it. And no matter how much you tote small business and other things, there are no jobs. This economy is stagnant in terms of jobs and many other things. I'm a former retired economist, and I have seen good during the Kennedy administration. I have seen people come in and do good things to turn the economy around. But these people, Summers and the rest, they don't have it.
Well, there are two pieces to that question. One, sort of the bipartisan nature of of why, given the promises that he had sort of made in the campaign in terms of being, I don't think he ever said to be he was a centrist, but I do think he was clearly saying that he was going to work with sort of across the ideological spectrum to get things done. And I think he came here and found that that's a lot more difficult, in the sense of you have your base wanting you to stay very much aligned with what you said your ideology was, versus the need to sort of create that broader majority coalition. That's just a very complicated thing, which I would have to say the general reaction from the public is he hasn't managed that well. And that's been part of the reason you've seen his job approval sort of slip. In terms of, again, just sort of the other element that I think he's had that is equally has been difficult and I think disappointing to some folks is the fact that he just wanders from issue to issue. He's been bouncing from issue to issue. Outside of the sort of command focus on health care, you know, 1 week it's immigration, 1 week it's cap and trade, when everybody's been sort of saying, well, what about the economy? And so I think there's a sense at this point, and again, when you see the job approvals form, it's not that people have gone seriously negative in terms of where things were toward the end of the Bush years, where it was like 35% approved and 50% disapproved, but it's gotten down to where it's about 1-to-1, and he's at a real critical stage, and we'll see how he manages this over the next couple of months. The White House is clearly aware of it, and that's... sort of going back to what Gibbs said yesterday, the fact that they're even willing to even say potentially that the House could flip represents the seriousness in terms of the White House viewing the present political situation.
All things political, continuing in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. June, thanks very much for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we are going to be talking about only children. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the positions taken by both Scott Walker and Mark Newman on that they would repeal the smoking ban. And I would respectfully offer this for the consideration of the lady that just called, because this is another example of some core thinking on the part of Republicans, and also, I think, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And the concept is that anything goes to make a buck. And time and time again, we see examples of how deregulation has failed and how people take advantage of deregulation to make a buck at the cost of hurting other people. That happens when you allow smoke in restaurants. The people that want to patronize the restaurant have to suffer the consequences, and they have no choice in the matter. Likewise, deregulation has hurt us in BP, Wall Street, Enron, where they ripped off elderly people along with others on energy prices. And it just comes down to selfishness. I want to make a buck by any means necessary, and I don't want to be impeded by the government. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. And it's selfishness. We have to humble ourselves and understand that we're not God and that we are accountable to other people.
David.
Well, I mean, the dynamic there is obviously what's the appropriate balance to strike. Not being familiar specifically with the smoking issue within the state, it's hard for me to address. But you know, part of it is again looking at these situations and was it in fact regulations that were the problem? Is there a need? How do you effectively balance what's the downside and upside? In terms of some of this that occurred in terms of the drilling, one of the questions is there may have been regulations in place, but in fact the government just didn't effectively enforce them, and so the problem wasn't regulations. The problem is just the ability to enforce. So, you sort of get into a specific area that I think right now where the public is at, and it has nothing to do necessarily with some of the outcomes as the gentleman was describing, but the concern right now that government is tending to overreach in a way that is negatively impacting the economy in such a way that it's stifling job growth. And again, this is going to be a pendulum swing back and forth as we see this evolve. But right now, my sense is the public is we need to do something to get the private sector moving again. And additional regulations at this point are likely not to be well received.
Here's an email that's come in, David, from John. We have a worldwide recession. Which particular country or countries do you think doing better in their recovery than this country of that country or countries? Did they provide a stimulus?
Well, I mean, one of the countries that seems to be doing relatively well here seems to be Germany. There's also just another side of this. I mean, American expectations for the American economy is pretty significant in the sense of when you go overseas, the idea that you could sustain 3%, 4%, 5% growth a year is considered, you know, remarkable outcome, whereas people in the United States tend to sort of expect that. So setting different expectations. I have to say one of the more odd things was this recent G20 meeting where suddenly you had the European leadership sort of talking to the United States saying, gee, you really need to rein in spending and be concerned about deficit spending, given what they had done over previous years. And I'm not sure what the takeaway there is. It was just a very sort of unusual, unexpected moment.
Mark in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. This whole jobs creation thing, we keep wanting the government to do something about it, but we won't entertain an idea beyond that of capitalism. The capitalistic model is proved to not actually give a dang about creation of jobs because their main responsibility is to the bottom line. So unless we want to look at a different way of viewing economics, which we don't get economic professors or, for that matter, political scientists to tell us that there are actually other ways out there, we're not going to succeed. If you look at the Mondragon Spain system, in the 1980s, the unemployment rate in Spain as a country was 27%. But within the Mondragon worker-owner co-op model, which is a cooperative model which subjugates the role of capital, the unemployment rate for those companies was 0.6%. So unless we want to look at some other form of ownership and a way of looking at the role of capital, our economic systems are doomed to the kind of failures that we see in these boom and bust things and a complete total disloyalty of the capital itself to the workforce. The workforce is just something that they buy and they go all around the world trying to find the cheapest labor force with the least laws and that kind of thing.
Let's get a response from David because we're short on time and I want to get to one more.
I'd have to say, first off, I mean, the Spain model probably isn't one of the best, given the fact that right now their unemployment is around 20%, and Spain is seriously struggling. And I guess I would suggest, I mean, what you're seeing here is and that's occurring, which has been a discussion that has been going on in the United States for quite a while, is the fight between sort of, and fight is too strong a word, but the debate between Keynesians and supply-siders. And this tends to go back and forth. I tend to sort of side with the supply siders, but this has been sort of an intellectual economic debate that's gone on for a while, and part of that is obviously where does economic growth come from? And economic growth is what creates jobs. Does economic growth come from effective government policy, or does it come from businesses effectively growing and expanding? And that's just a pretty significant debate. I obviously being a Republican side on one side of that, but that's the basic debate that is sort of occurring. And like I said, at this particular point, what Obama is sort of dealing with is he's tried the Keynesian side, and for whatever reason, at least at this point, there's a frustration because things haven't improved. And so that's kind of where the public is at this point. There's a frustration with the Keynesian side, but then, again, like I was saying earlier, the Republicans have yet to sort of step forward and say, okay, here's what we would do.
Is this the time for both parties to take up the immigration issue?
Immigration is a really important issue, but the answer is until jobs and the economy are fixed, a lot of the resources that would be needed to at a variety of different levels to deal with all these issues just aren't clear and aren't in place. And so the answer to that, I would say, is at this point, the public wants jobs and the economy, so immigration, this is not the time for this discussion.
Afghanistan, is this the time to change strategy in Afghanistan?
That's the Americans have this interesting tolerance when it comes to, again, jobs and the economy being the most important thing, but understanding that national security needs to be sustained and needs to be managed in the most effective way. So there's a sense of obviously you have to pay attention to that. But what people want to see is whatever we're going to do is the thing that is going to most make security in this country better.
Thank you, David. Pleasure. Nice to chat with you
Good
again.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. David Winston, president of the Winston Group, our guest the first half hour of All Things Political. It's a strategic planning and survey research firm, formerly director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, where he worked on education, taxes, Social Security, healthcare, and technology. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and served as a senior staffer to four RNC chairmen. He's a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call and an election analyst for CBS. We continue All Things Political, different guests this half hour, although your phone calls always welcome. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Sam Stein is a political reporter at the Huffington Post. He has worked for Newsweek magazine, the New York Daily News, and the investigative journalism group Center for Public Integrity. And he is our guest this half hour of the program. Hello, Sam. Nice to talk to you again.
Oh, nice talking to you as well.
Our last guest, David Winston, and our audience spent a lot of time talking about jobs. He said that the president doesn't seem to grasp that the American people are focused on the economy. He goes from one issue to another issue to another issue without a major focus on doing something about creating jobs, stimulating this economy. Do you think David Winston was right?
That might be a little harsh. I think that the White House certainly knows when you speak with any of the officials there that, you know, their political lives essentially are, you know, tied to this economic recovery. There's not much else that voters tend to care about. I know that deficits are the trend right now, but if you look at the polling data, it's always about jobs and the economy, and I don't think the White House is out to lunch with respect to that. Unfortunately, they've been confronted with a oil spill that's lasted 70 days, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much, you know, there is a demand to focus on that. And then there's terrorism trials and a whole host of different conflicts or crises that are popping up. But if you talk to any of the president's officials in private or even in public, they know that it's about the economic recovery. The question is, what kind of tools do they have to affect faster turnaround? And if you saw the Sunday shows yesterday, you know, David Axelrod, for one, said there's no appetite to do additional spending up in Congress. And without more stimulative spending, it's very tough to get this economy back on track.
So what kind of tools are they left with, Sam?
That's a good question. If I had a degree in economics, maybe I would know what else there is to do. But, you know, basic Keynesian economic theory holds that you pump the system until there's a recovery. And so passing the stimulus, roughly $800 billion stimulus at the beginning of the term was a good start, probably. The problem now is that they went for the big chunk, and there's no appetite for anything additionally. And so what you see is Congress can't even pass a $30 billion unemployment benefit extension right now, which, if you look at the economic models, would be actually quite stimulative in terms of getting people purchasing power, money in their hands, and also not to mention the moral and ethics of helping out the unemployed. There's a real problem here for the administration. It's not one of it's not for lack of want that they are suffering. It's because Congress has real skepticism about additional spending right now, and that would be the primary method to create jobs.
Robert Gibbs was talking about the possibility of the House picking up some seats, maybe as many as 39 seats in the midterm election. Two questions: would you agree with him, and what would that mean for what would the Republicans need to present in terms of an alternative to this current administration to assure themselves of that kind of victory and maybe more seats?
I agree with him. I'm not a prognosticator, but everyone I talk to, from the campaign committees to the top strategists in the party, are increasingly convinced that there is a real possibility of losing power in the House of Representatives, which would be dramatic change in power, obviously. And to this point, I don't think the Republicans have to do all that much in terms of presenting a viable alternative. They haven't so far, and they've done very well for it. a lot of it is sort of demonizing the Obama administration and Democrats in Congress for the agenda that they've been working on. You see in the polls that they haven't really had much of an uptick in terms of their own popularity, the Republicans, that is. Their brand ID is still below 50. They just haven't really had much of an improvement in terms of popularity. But they've been very successful in demonizing the Democratic Party for its platform. And it could very well result in us seeing a Speaker John Boehner in next January.
And so people are voting, would be voting not for something, they would be voting as a statement if things are bad?
Yeah, and you know, I know it's sort of the conventional wisdom is that you have to vote for, you know, voters don't want to vote against something, they want to vote for something. And it may be to the extent that deficit concerns are driving voter anxiety and the Republicans are promising to deal with that, that could be one thing. But if you ask around, there's not much of a meaty, substantive Republican alternative platform. It's primarily the same type of things that you would expect from the GOP, which is primarily tax cuts and less spending. I mean, they've been very good at demonizing the healthcare legislation. They've talked a lot about border security. Foreign policy debates really don't register in terms of the voters, and not to mention that Republican Party tends to find themselves in line with the president on Afghanistan and Iraq, maybe not terrorism, but those things, there's really the only major difference is the social programs and the spending and taxing. And I think Republicans feel like they can ride that and fear of the Democratic agenda to victory in November.
Let's go to some calls. John, who is west of Madison. Hi, John.
Good morning. Good to hear you all.
Morning.
I am a very centrist Democrat with a good economics education and pay quite a bit of attention to what Paul Krugman says. People badly misuse the word what Keynesian means, but my observation goes a little bit beyond that. I think that Barack Obama is a failed president because he disregarded what everybody from the Nixon White House told him when he assembled his staff. And I think that he should have listened. They told him very carefully, do not keep political people like Rahm Emanuel into the chief of staff position. They told him not to bring his political operatives in as his primary advisors. And I would be interested in the take that your guest has on pulling down to the nuts and bolts and taking a look at the fundamental decisions he made and how he organized his administration.
I'm sorry, John, whose advice did he ignore?
When Barack Obama was elected, all of the staffers of the Nixon White House, who people generally disregard because of Watergate and all of that,
right,
they had a lot of people who knew how to organize and get things done. And they held a program at the Reagan Library and were very emphatic about how Obama should organize his staff in order to be effective and to do things like Nixon did things effective in negotiating with the Chinese and things like that that people disregard and overlook because the man had so many obvious criminal flaws. But Obama's problem is that he exercised no effective control over the House and let these people run around for 18 months like they mattered, and a lot of other things. And it all goes to the staff and who his people are. He can't do everything.
Okay. Sam?
There's a lot to unpackage there. I think the caller is right in some respects. One of the more illustrative articles in the past week was this piece in the New York Times that talked about how the political advisors, the Rahm Emanuels, the David Axelrods, were telling Obama to stop stimulative spending and to focus strictly on the deficit because that was what voters were concerned about. And it was the economic advisors of all people who were saying, no, you need to keep pumping the system. And I think that goes, I think that gets at what the caller is talking about, which is that you have people who maybe are almost too attuned to or too fearful of the Tea Party movement advising the president when actual sound economic policy should reign supreme. On the flip side, though, we can't ignore some of the major accomplishments that this administration has put together, and healthcare is obviously one of them. You have a healthcare bill that falls very much short of where progressives wanted it to be, and I understand that, but
let's keep in mind that this is the biggest, most sweeping piece of social policy in 50 years. And he did that within the first year and a half of his administration. And there's a whole host of other things that we can't ignore. I mean, the stimulus package was massive. And I think there's a fair argument to make that without it, we would find ourselves in a massive depression right now. The TARP, for all of the problems that are associated with it, has actually been successful. And it's returned money to the government. No one really talks about that. I mean, the TARP is vilified, but in terms of historical analysis, I bet we look back at it and say it was probably a success. So, you know, we have to give the administration some due on its victories, while at the same time acknowledging that, you know, some of the advice that this president has gotten probably is, you know, a little short-sighted. But let's look at both sides of the equation, I say.
All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network, and we'll continue with your phone calls in a moment. Sam Stein is our guest right now. He's political reporter at the Huffington Post. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Dave in Menominee, Michigan.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Dave.
You know, another thing that people just don't seem to mention, I don't hear it, we kind of act like this recession is something like, you know, the employers, the companies, the manufacturers, the mills, the factories, like in Menominee. It isn't like they cut back and we're just waiting for them to start hiring people back. They left. They're gone. The buildings are empty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like we're just waiting for somebody to just hire some people back. And that's how it sounds like people are covering this. And it's not that at all. It is, they are gone. Menominee's a skeleton. Those buildings are not going to be filled up anytime soon. And, you know, it's got to be very difficult for a guy to come into the job where the cities have become skeletons and try to, you know, get everything going in a year, what, 15 months? I just wanted to get, you know, the guest's comments on that.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
One of the more salient points, you know, this economic collapse that happened in 2007 and 2008 was proceeded well in advance. I know that there was uninterrupted job growth during the Bush administration, but you also saw the real gutting of manufacturing in this country. And when you lose entire industries overseas, it's almost impossible to get those jobs back. You have to really restructure the whole construct of the economy. And so one of the things this administration likes to say is that the reason to pass energy legislation, of all things, is because you can actually create new industries through it. Green jobs industry. I know it sounds quaint, but you can employ millions of people in those industries, and you need to actually modernize the economy in that sense because it's, you know, they won't admit it, but you're not going back to a lot of the industrialism that we had. So, yeah, it's a great point, and it's a huge deficit that the Obama administration has to deal with. It'd be one thing if you could just get the jobs back, but you actually have to restructure the entire economy, and, you know, one stimulus bill is not going to do that.
So what kind of progress is being made, Sam, on starting those kinds of jobs, starting the companies? Is it beginning?
Yeah, I mean, they've made investments through that stimulus package on some of these, but the investments are very small in the broad scheme of things. I mean, light rail was one of the things that this administration really wanted to revitalize, which is to put in a modernized rail system throughout this country that would essentially connect the entire country and be very much like the European model. But because of concerns over spending and the size of the stimulus package, they had to really scale that back. Again, the energy bill has a whole host of goodies for green jobs. And the problem, of course, is that you can't pass an energy bill in this politicized climate. And so we're sitting on something that could potentially have massive benefits for the entire country, but we're so stuck in a debate over whether the deficit is too big that in all likelihood, we're not going to get it. Although I should add, the energy legislation was scored by the CBO the other day, and it was found to reduce the deficit. But there's serious concerns about implementing a cap and trade system, and as well as the offshore drilling component of the energy bill. So, you know, all indications say that this bill is not going to be passed before the elections. And if you lose Democratic seats in the elections, then who knows when it's going to be passed.
Thank you, Dave, for your call. We go to Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I'd just like to tie the caller from Oconomowoc, which I think has happened, and the last caller's comment concerning tying the country with trains, because I think there are 30 million people in this country essentially with no means of employment that are puttering around. You know, could we have a rail, does the host ever and the guest think that we'll ever have a 400-mile-per-hour train, you know, tying Los Angeles to New York, Los Angeles to California, from Chicago to southern Florida, and maybe from Milwaukee to Madison, going 100 miles an hour faster than anything the French have got.
What do you think, Sam?
Well, I wish I was more of a rail expert and could answer that with some conviction. I know that there are hopes and plans in government here to do that. There's also real concerns about how Amtrak has managed its finances. A little while ago, they had to be essentially bailed out by the government because of essentially people were just not taking the train outside the Northeast Corridor. So, you know, there's real concerns about whether it's economically feasible. I hope so. I tend to think that it's a great way to not only tie the country together, but create jobs and modernize our transportation system. And also, it's far less of a pollutant than cars and even planes. And so it makes sense. The question is whether there's the willpower in Congress. And beyond that, I don't really have much insight into the rail development of our country.
Here's an email from Marie. Why are we separating energy, immigration, war, et cetera, from the economy?
Well, not many. I mean, some people aren't. I know that there's a big movement in Congress right now to say that, you know, we got to tackle a defense budget, that if we want to continue war in Afghanistan and Iraq, we got to pay for it elsewhere. We can't just cut checks and assume that that's not going to affect our long-term fiscal viability. But in the broader sense, you know, a lot of these policies, and I go back to healthcare on this one, because healthcare reform was a deficit reducer. The CBO estimated that it could be as much as, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. And one of the things that surprised me about that debate was that the Democratic Party never sold the bill in a real comprehensive way as a deficit reducer. And I thought that that was a mistake. They could have done much better, would have made the process much smoother, I think, if they had insisted from the very beginning that if you voted for this bill, you were working on our country's fiscal health, essentially. Because all these things are tied together. And so, yeah, immigration, in many respects, Bill Clinton goes on, when he talks about immigration, he says, you can't kick 12 million people out of here. And also, if you let immigrants into the country through a legal and a comprehensive process, you're going to actually get tax generators, people who pay taxes. That helps. And they do jobs. And, you know, this is an economic bill. So, in short, I think the Democratic Party could do a better job tying all these things to fiscal issues.
Can you imagine being able to reach any kind of compromise on immigration reform right now? Oh,
no.
My gosh.
I think it's impossible. I know that there's a lot of talk about it, but, you know, the president gave a speech recently about immigration reform, and what stood out for me was how unspecific it was. I mean, it was essentially an overview of the debate. He said there's merits to each side of the argument and we need to come together. But if he had any hopes of passing a bill soon, he would have laid out some specifics, and he didn't. There's just no way at this point in time in this political climate that there can be an agreement between the two parties.
Right. And yet it's so obvious, which is so frustrating to a lot of people, that somebody needs to look at it seriously.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, in the context of other countries and their immigration problems, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world, our system, but the solution seems pretty obvious to sober-minded viewers. You have to obviously deal with the people who are here already, You can't just deport them. At the same time, you can't just give them blanket amnesty. There's got to be a pretty comprehensive path to citizenship. And then you have to deal with border enforcement and security. And I think the administration's taken a few steps there by sending down National Guard troops to the border. I know there's been stalling on the building of a virtual fence along the border because of concerns about costs and the effectiveness of it. But those are the basic steps, and everyone sort of agrees to it, except we get caught in a debate over, you know, semantics and language. And, you know, at the same time, it has to be said, there were 11 Republicans who voted for essentially that path or when it came up a couple years ago under the Bush administration, and those 11 Republicans would not today vote for it.
Right.
Because they know of the they know that the political ramifications in their own party are way too strong. And the case of John McCain is probably the brightest. Here's someone who made it a cause and now is in a primary in Arizona and won't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. Thanks, Ken. Greg is next. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I just wanted to get back to one thing that was discussed earlier, and I came to the discussion late, so you can correct me if I miss something. But people voted for Obama across all kinds of lines in this whole thing. And I did, and I also know a number of Republicans and a whole host of independents. And the idea of change and changing the way you know, he sold that idea pretty well to the country about changing the way things are doing, things are done in Washington. And then, you know, loads up his staff with Washington insiders, lobbyists, appoints people to high positions in the USDA, FDA, who are industry insiders and lobbyists in their backgrounds. And people who go out of their way, because you don't get this even in the normal press. You like myself, people who like to see really what's going on. We research, and I was appalled by so much of his appointment situation. And then as we discuss this, we don't really discuss what's really going on. We all let the parties polarize it in their business as usual manner, and the point of several of my pretty Republican friends who supported Obama was simply, well, you know, if they would change something regarding campaign finance, that's our only hope at getting at anything, because we can't. As long as the parties are successful in polarizing the debate and keep our mind off of all of the special interest money that really outranks our votes, and people in both parties know this.
Sam?
There's a lot there. I mean, to begin with, did the Obama administration sort of walk away from its promise to change the tone and construct of politics in Washington? Yes and no. I mean, they clearly have implemented ethics laws in the White House that are stronger than anything that any other administration has have done, whether it's disclosure or banning lobbyists. At the same time, the caller's right. They appointed a lot of insiders into key posts. But that's primarily because those are the people who know how to what the job entails. I mean, you can't take someone randomly off the street. I don't know if it's off the street, but it's very difficult to staff an administration like that without turning to people who have experience in prior administrations. So in some respects, it's hard to hit them on that. In terms of, you know, whether our politics is too beholden to special interest or too partisan, of course it is. And the caller's right to note that campaign finance reform would be a big help. You look at the financial regulatory reform debate, for instance, there were a whole host of loopholes that were put into the legislative language at the behest of special interest groups. If you even look at the campaign finance legislation that was just passed through the House, it's called the Disclose Act. It would create an immense amount of disclosure among groups who spend on the political process. Ironically, the National Rifle Association managed to get an exemption added. I mean, we're talking about ethics legislation that was crafted with a huge loophole added for the biggest gun lobby. I mean, if that doesn't say something about the state of Washington, then I don't know what does. Now, on the flip side, passing that legislation would do wonders for disclosure. But, you know, that's the political process. It's very much determined by who's got the most money, and it's depressing in many respects.
What do you think of Chicago's reaction to the Supreme Court decision on handguns? They're requiring people to take lengthy training courses. You can't take the gun outside the house. You got to work at firing ranges, et cetera. Will that be challenged?
I mean, I think it's going to be challenged, but not in the way you expect. The NRA is actually going to use the decision that the Supreme Court handed down and try to challenge even more local ordinances. And so you're going to see a whole host of cities who have restrictions on who can actually purchase guns, whether it's, you know, criminal back checks or anything else that restricts how you purchase a gun. And they're going to make it, they're going to bring that to court. I've been almost shocked, I think, in the past couple of weeks about how powerful the gun lobby really is. I mean, I know it's sort of a cliche that they run this place, but they do actually run this place. The White House won't touch guns. It's just not an issue that they want to get into. Congress, as I mentioned earlier, with the campaign finance legislation, can't pass anything that the NRA doesn't, you know, explicitly sign off on or implicitly sign off on. And the Supreme Court, too, is now very much stacked in favor of the gun interest. And so, you know, what once was a very substantive, weighty debate 30, 20 years ago about gun rights in this country is now essentially over.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam, so much for being with
problem.
Us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Sam Stein, political reporter for the Huffington Post. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks for all of your calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. Call again, please. We'll return.